Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:44 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Excuse me, summertime. And today is Friday and it is April 28th. So it is the big picture long-term video and audio for the various different asset classes. And I'm going to kick off this week looking at Google. It is up $37 today on strong earnings from just after the close last night. And this is a pretty impressive reassertion of the medium-term bull market. And we can see that it has been trending higher in a reasonably consistent manner since 2013, and that the step sequence bull market that had prevailed really until the middle of last year has given way into a more persistent advance, where I think the best way to talk about it is that the trend has been now characterized by a progression of higher reaction lows where support has been found in the region of the trend mean rather than the step sequence that we had had previously. What does that tell us in terms of supply and demand? It tells us that the imbalance between supply and demand is growing wider, that this is a trend that is becoming progressively, that is going up faster, that the pace of the advance is picking up, there is a rush on to buy Google shares. And not least because technology continues to represent one of the sectors that is got a clear story behind it. And the story is that we are in an era of digitization, that anything that can be disintermediated will be, that the number of steps that between the producer of a good or service and the consumer has continued to decline, and entire industries are being left by the wayside as a result. And companies like Google and Amazon, they're at the hard edge of that. So they are the kinds of companies that are benefiting enormously from not only the technological innovation, but being at the forefront of it. I think it is interesting that both shares are climbing towards that psychological $1,000 level, and in the context of what has been an incredibly impressive bull market since 2009 at least, and we can see here from Amazon, for example, that it rallied from a low of $34 in 2008 to the current $925. I'm going to let someone else figure out what the exact percentage advance that is, but it is incredibly impressive. We can also see that it has, on occasion, pulled back violently, and that every time it becomes way overextended relative to the trend mean, it has pulled back to unwind that overextension. And it is well off its high in here today. When we look at some of the other technology shares that are out there, I think you know the Chinese technology shares have done almost as well. That you have Tencent Holdings, which went from really quite depressed levels in 2007. It was trading around $4, and now it's at 243. So that is an incredibly impressive advance, and it is also really quite overextended as it approaches the psychological $250 area. One of the considering the competition that there is for education in China, Tal Education is one of those companies that does rather well from tutoring, but it has quite clearly accelerated since the beginning of this year, and now it is off its peak in here today. And I want to show these charts just to highlight the fact that shares are best bought following reactions, and that this is a buy low, sell high game. So this is not the most opportune time to be increasing one's positions, regardless of the fact that the technology sector is gaining an increasing number of headlines and is continuing to represent the clear and far and away winner in terms of stock market performance. That we have got, if we spoke about the concentration of returns last year, that is even more of a factor this year. And against the and all of this is happening against a background where there are an increasing number of uncertainties, and obviously some people will be saying that the market climbs a wall of worry. That has certainly been the case in terms of this bull market that has been in evidence since the latter stages of 2008 and the beginning of 2009. It has been climbing successfully hurdles of worry. Right now, we have all of these considerations about the political process. I think Theresa May is rather astute. She is, by going to the people in the UK, she is avoiding the kind of issue that President Trump is now having, and whoever the next president of France is likely to have. And whoever wins the election in France is going to have much the same problem that Trump has, because Trump got elected on an anti-government policy, and he ran on an anti-establishment ticket. But unfortunately, he is relying on the support of establishment figures to push through his agenda, and that is not a simple process. And we are seeing ample evidence of that right now, where there has been substantial flip-flopping on just about every question. There is still the hope that he will be able to muster support to really gain the votes that he can to push through some kind of reform of the tax system, some kind of fiscal spending. Are they going to be as outrightly inflationary and stimulative that many people had been expecting? It's probably unlikely, because there is a substantial conservative bloc within the Republican Party that is really legislating on principle. And they are really quite unlikely to vote for anything that increases deficits. So there's going to have to be a lot of pleading, cajoling, and arm twisting to get anything through. And the Democratic Party is going to do exactly what the Republican Party did when they were faced with Obama. They are going to oppose absolutely everything on the principle that they have as much ambivalence towards Trump as the Republicans did for Obama. So it is going to be another 4 years where there is going to be increasing polarization between the parties. And then we look at France. If Le Pen wins, it is going to create a political problem. But by the same token, Macron is also a divisive figure, because he doesn't represent either of the incumbent parties. When they have a general election, and there's a very large question whether he's going to have enough candidates to field in in every constituency to try and wrest control of the country from the two incumbent parties. So you're going to have a president in either case of France who is not supported by the political establishment, and that is going to create deadlock. That is going to create a rather difficult environment overall. When and I think that is not really being reflected in the currency at present. When we look at the euro, it is currently trading just shy of 109 to the dollar. The most important thing that it did this week was to break upwards in an emphatic manner after the French election vote last weekend. A week is a long time in politics, and what happens in the French election over the next, I guess it's going to be about 10 sessions, is really going to give us a lot of indication about where we can anticipate the currency and indeed the stock market in Europe to go. The European stock market has pushed back up towards the high that we saw in 2015. The reason it got to that peak in 2015 was because of the devaluation of the euro. And it has rallied now because of, I think, enthusiasm that the EU is growing. It's only growing at 0.4 of 1%, which will, and the fact that that is described as robust will tell us that just how modest expectations are. But one of the reasons that Theresa May went to the people in the UK was because she needed to have a stronger hand. She needed to quell the, I think, the unruly way that her own party were reacting to the people's decision to exit the EU. And I think that that was the was an astute political move, both from the perspective of potentially increasing her majority, but most particularly to ensure that she has legislators that are willing to support the will of the people. And that is, in fact, what a general election is for. I think that when we look at the UK, we are at least seeing some evidence that they are beginning to do things the right way around, and perhaps that is now being reflected in the currency markets. The pound is up to 129.5 versus the dollar, and I think anybody can see that it spent a good deal of time ranging for much of the last 6 months, and now it is breaking up out of this short-term base. It is trading back above the trend mean for the first time since before the Brexit vote. And as long as it is holding that move above the trend mean and holding the breakout, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. I think that that is the other point, of course, is that the pound had been trending lower for 3 years already, and that the decision to exit the euro has been an acceleration of that trend. When we look at the euro and the pound, the pound had accelerated lower to that 95p area, and now it's trading at 84p. It had steadied up somewhat this week, but I think the most important thing is that it is now also trading stronger than the trend mean versus the euro. So there is a lot to play for, and the UK has got really big questions to be asked. But I think when we think about the big picture in the long term, we have to consider that there are important themes that are playing out that have contributed to the political situation such as it is. The rise of populism, it did not happen randomly. It is a symptom of, I think, two important themes. One is that we have had this rapid pace of technological innovation that has contributed to the outperformance of the technology sector, and it has also contributed to the rising standards of living that we have all enjoyed. But what it is, then, I think that is an argumentative term, because some people will argue that their standard of living has decreased because they have less disposable income. The cost of living has increased. But why has the cost of living increased while we have had this disinflationary technological innovation? When we look at the velocity of money, I think, and I find it to be really a fascinating chart, because it started deteriorating in 1997, and it hasn't stopped going down. So we know what, and central banks have taken on a great deal of additional responsibility, but if we really think about it, what is it that central banks are supposed to do? Their number one function is to ensure that there is sufficient money in the system to encourage economic growth. And with the velocity of money deteriorating, and deteriorating in really quite a sharp manner, and this is an index that is updated quarterly with a quarterly lag, so we probably won't get the end of March figure until the end of June. But we would need something profound to change this downtrend. At the beginning of 2009, it popped on the upside and then quickly deteriorated. It makes the question about how the Fed is going to withdraw all of that liquidity rather risible, because if the function of the central bank is to ensure there is enough liquidity in the system, to promote economic growth and the velocity of that money is deteriorating, then that necessarily means that there's going to have to be more money added to the system. That's exactly what we have had. The problem is that if you add all of that money into the economic system, what you are in fact doing is inflating asset prices. We have seen ample evidence of asset prices inflating for asset holders. So property prices have risen, commercial property prices have risen, stock prices have risen, bond prices have risen. And for the holders of those assets, standards of living have improved. The problem is that for the masses of people who vote but do not own those assets, then standards of living have not improved, not nearly to the same extent as the pace of technological innovation has helped to improve their standards of living, and that has contributed to the rise of populism. The fact that you have had massive bailouts where you have had socialization of private sector debts and the onus for paying back those debts has been put on to voters has contributed to this disaffection with the political process. So when we think about the rise of populism, we can see it as a symptom of what I think in many respects could have been described and should be described as the abuse of capitalism. Capitalism is perhaps the, by far and away, the best economic system that there is. But just like any other system, it is occasionally corrupted, because what should have been allowed to occur was a dissolution of the banks, of the outstanding bad loans. The U.S. did perhaps the best job that it could, and created a system where you did have a resolution of the banking of the banking problems, and the banking sector is now in much ruder health. But that did not occur in Europe, and I think that very fact means that while you have the U.S. banking sector, which surged higher on President Trump, but has been rallying in a reasonably persistent manner since 2008. That the fact that that is looking so much different from the performance of the European banking sector, then what does that tell us? It tells us that these regions have taken a very different approach to the problems that face the banking sector. And the fact that the Europeans have not been able to muster the organization and really been able to gel together in a federalist state, that has really made sure that they were not able to do what the U.S. was able to do. The fact that they're not going to have a deposit insurance corporation for the Eurozone until the early 2020s is also a reflection of the fact that the European Union is moving based on the electoral timetables of the various large members. And when we look at the shorter term outlook for the European banks, they do look like they are recovering from here. They are at least rallying from the lower side of the range back up towards the upper side of the range. It's an entirely different question whether they are going to be able to sustain a move above 200, but there is a substantial rally potential between here and there. The simple fact is that the Europeans are, and international investors have concluded, that Marine Le Pen is not going to win the French election. Personally, I would be a little reticent about drawing that exact conclusion just yet. I think voter turnout is going to be very low, and that introduces a wild card into the French electoral result that is not in the market at all right now. And that also means that, you know, because it is only only 1 week away, that there is a risk that we could have an unruly outcome. And that, I think, is something that we do need to keep in mind. But in the event that Marine Le Pen does not win the French election, that will certainly confirm that the risk-off that has been really a characteristic of the stock market for much of the last 6 weeks is indeed over. and that we will be back in a risk-on environment, particularly for Europe. Europe has got a substantial number of problems. It has already surmounted the Dutch election. It is on the cusp of surmounting the French election. The next big one will be Germany, and whether Angela Merkel can push it to a fourth term. The polls are pretty close right now. But even if you have the SPD winning in Germany, then they are still a Europhile party, although considerably more populist than the CDU. When we look at this European banking sector, it is really quite depressed. It has ample potential to advance from here, and simply because of the removal of at least part of the risk premium that has been attached to the market. But isn't it interesting that when we look at the European banking sector and we look at the Japanese banking sector, the Topics banks hit an important peak in 1989, early 1990, and remain within this lengthy base formation. They were dirt cheap in the early 2000s and experienced a pretty impressive rally, but they are now trading back at levels that were that are similar to where they were in 2003. And the valuations are probably not as attractive today. When we just look at it on the weekly chart, then we had an impressive rally at the end of last year, which has given way to a pullback, and the index is now trading in the region of the trend mean. It tested the lower side of the overhead trading range just last week, and the extent to which that it can hold this rally over the last 2 weeks and then improve upon it will give us will tell us a lot about the ability of the banking sector to rally. I think Japan is one of the more interesting markets because the Topics index has been trading below 1750 for the better part of 25 years. So if it can eventually break above that level, then we will be in a new bull market. The other big market that has been in one of these incredibly lengthy ranges is Taiwan. It has been ranging below 10,000 since 1990. And if it can sustain a move to new highs, then it's probably unlikely to be able to do that in isolation. It's quite likely that considering the relationship that there is between the Japanese and the Taiwanese markets, that they would do so in tandem. And that it then brings us to a large question. We have had a great deal of money flowing into the system. Interest rates are incredibly low, and the number of shares that are in evidence has halved in the last 20 years, the number of issued shares out there on the market. Now the big question is, what's going to happen with government bond yields? Because we can see that government bond yields have been ranging since the middle of 2011, and we're towards the upper side of that range, and the yield is currently trading in the region of the trend mean. The yield has been compressing for a good long time. There is certainly a loss of momentum evident, but it is not the first time that we've had a loss of momentum. We had a loss of momentum between 2000 and about 2007 as well. But subsequently, we had a massive crisis, and the pace of the advance picked up once more. But this looks like a range, at least. A sustained move to new lows would be required to question that it is not a base formation. A sustained move above 3% would confirm that we'd had base formation completion. If we have a sustained move above 3%, and I think that one of the more interesting charts out there is the 2-year yield chart. It's currently trading at 1.25%. And I think that rather than think about what it is, we should perhaps look at the shape of the trend. Because it looks like a first step above the base. that there has been a progression of higher reaction lows that has been pretty much intact since the beginning of 2013. So that was when we had the taper tantrum. And ever since the taper tantrum, the 2 year has been moving gently higher. The fact that it is only at 1.25% suggests that bond investors are not willing to price in any potential for interest rate hikes. And that is potentially the way that I've characterized this before is that it is like the boy who cried wolf. The Fed has made prognostications about raising interest rates on a number of occasions, and then they didn't do it. So bond investors have learned that there is absolutely no point listening to the Fed, that rather they should just listen to the market. And they are unwilling to price in the potential for interest rate hikes. They're still in this deflationary mindset. But wages are rising. And I think that that is something that is has perhaps not really begun to factor in, that we are seeing that earnings are rising. And if that is in case indeed the case, well, eventually that is going to factor through into inflationary pressures. So I think that we are at a point where I think it is dangerous to really simply think that we're not going to have interest rates rising. If I just want to pull this chart over, and it is the US average hourly earnings, and it has been range bound for the last 6 months, but that to me at least looks like a really quite a clear base formation completion. Wages have on average the pace with which earnings are increasing, which is about 2.7% right now, has been picking up. When people are asking for more money for doing the same job, well, then that is, I think, perhaps even the easiest definition of inflation. So when we go back and look at that long-term chart, then the chances are that we are moving into a new inflationary cycle. If that is indeed the case, then that could be potentially very bullish for Japan. It could be very bullish for Taiwan, because these are markets that have gone sideways for a very prolonged period of time. The FTSE 100 has just broken out of a 17-year range. It came back to test the 7,000 level this week and bounced reasonably impressively. When we look at that over the really long term, then there is real potential for the UK stock market to have completed a secular bear market. Secular bear markets in stocks generally are characterized by very volatile, lengthy ranges. We have seen ample evidence of that over the last 100 years, and the S&P 500 broke out of its range in 2013. The Europeans aren't even close to that, neither is Japan. The other market that has broken up and out of a lengthy range recently is India. The index ranged, and that's of course in nominal terms, it ranged sideways for 2.5 years, but that was in the context of a market that had deteriorated substantially because of the weakness of the currency. If we look at this in US dollar terms, then we are presented with a really quite different chart. The reason that the market is now doing better is because the U currency is strengthening up, and this is different. The rupee, when we look at the long-term chart of the rupee, it really only ever gets weaker. And now we're in a period of time where it is strengthening, and this is a green light for foreign investors. Not only do you have a strong reform-minded government, but then you're also seeing that there is a nexus of technological innovation where 4G has just been rolled out, and that really does unleash the potential for massive application of technological innovation to enhance the standards of living for millions of people. That 40% of the population is illiterate, and even a child can use a mobile phone. But most particularly with fingerprint identification, it means, and the fact that that is built into phones, it means that people who can't read can have bank accounts. The fact that you've had the demonetization and the threat of additional demonetization, the fact that you're having the rollout of mobile banking to large numbers of people, these are profound differences. This is something that is really quite is changing very, very rapidly. But most particularly, it's happening in one of the highest population countries. So when we think about the big picture, the long term, technological innovation is not only accelerating, but it's accelerating in an exponential manner. It is accelerating faster than it is easy to comprehend. And most particularly, that is happening in high population countries where governance is improving. One of the great themes is not so much that we're having technological innovation, but that it goes instantly global. That something that is discovered and innovated upon in one country, because we have a global economy, these things are going global instantly. And that is helping to enhance the productive capacity of everybody. We're going to have massive population growth, an additional upwards of 2 to 3 billion people in the next 30 years. The majority of them are going to be in Asia and Africa. Africa is going to probably see its population double in the next 30 years. It means that governance has to improve. If governance does not improve, well, then we are going to have some significant social problems, and even more intense social problems in the African region and the Middle Eastern region, because they are connected by a land bridge. Then the reality is that this is going to, if we do not have better governance, we are going to have worse social problems. So there is a massive incentive to encourage social development. And I think that there is ample potential for that to occur. We are seeing certainly that the application of technology, not least that this in just this week, the first malaria vaccine was released in Africa, and that's a first. It also, we're also seeing that there is great strides being made in herbal remedies to combat malarial infection. And these are really cost effective, and malaria is primarily an African problem, and we often talk about the impact that high oil prices have on GDP growth, but I think if we could get a figure for the how much malaria shaves off of economic growth in a country, then we could really start to put things into perspective. But energy is really quite a substantial theme. And when we look at oil prices, then I really do think that we're going to be in a volatile ranging phase for the lengthy medium term. The price right now is testing the region of the trend mean. It had a good bounce yesterday, and it was able to hold on to the majority of that today. But the big question is the extent to which prices can be sustained above $60, because there is a great deal of additional supply comes online above 60. The fact that you have hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling, these might be expensive to originally put down, but you get such prolific supply that you can recoup your costs pretty quickly. They do have this early decline rate, but after a few years, you can go back and refrac. The refracking costs substantially less. There were initial concerns that by going back and refracking that you could damage the field. There's been a lot of research done over the last couple of years on that, and they're proceeding rather cautiously with refracking. But the most important point is that it might cost $4 million to build, to initially drill an unconventional well, but it costs substantially less to go back and refrac it. That means that the unconventional oil and gas sector, because of the size that it has grown to and its ability to tailor supply to prices, it makes the US the swing producer. And that is a profound change. We've been writing about unconventional oil and gas being a game changer for the energy sector for nearly a decade already. And that hasn't changed. We're just now seeing just how profound that change really is. The fact that we have lower energy prices is both a factor of the excess supply that has come online after a decade-long process of investment in additional supply, but it is also the big, I think the next big story in the energy sector is that oil has competition in the transportation sector. That the energy density of batteries doubles about every 4.5 years. So there is a physical limit to how good a lithium-ion battery can get, but we have not come close to reaching that just yet. And it does suggest that we have cars today that have got a range of between 250 and 300 miles. It means that in 5 years' time, we'll have cars that will be have a range of between 250 and 600 miles, excuse me, between 500 and 600 miles. And within 9 years, we could have cars that can drive 1,000 miles on a single charge. Now, assuming that the cost of that car remains steady and that the cost of that car comes down to similar prices to what cars cost today, then the argument for transferring over to electric vehicles is highly compelling. But it isn't as if the electric vehicle movement is simply the only thing that's happening in transportation. The fact that autonomous vehicles are leaping ahead in capability, that Google launched its Waymo service in on a test basis in the city of Phoenix is just this week, has been really quite another profound change. There are obvious advantages to having a chauffeur drive you around. I think that recreational horse riding is great fun, but having a horse as a mode of transport comes with a lot of baggage. And it is very much the same thing with cars. So if we could have chauffeurs and have someone else drive us around, then that is much preferable. And I think that that is exactly what we're going to have. How long that takes to become truly commercial is open to question, but I think there is a sense of inevitability about it. It also means that the number of vehicles on the road could increase substantially. That represents a perhaps a bullish factor for transportation fuels. So there are really quite profound changes that are happening. The greatest risk to some of the larger companies, the kinds of companies that benefit from the rise of the global consumer, from lower energy prices, and the advance of technology, is that capitalism trends towards concentration. And the logical, I think the logical conclusion of concentration is antitrust. And that does represent a risk for companies like Google and Amazon, that they dominate their respective sectors. And they are so far away from their competitors, and that the barrier to entry is so high that they will eventually face the threat of antitrust. And when you think about the number of different business units that these companies are engaged in, then the perhaps the smartest thing that they could do would be to start hiving them off, just to avoid that antitrust. Well, I think that that represents a medium-term risk. perhaps even a long-term risk. I don't think that it is an imminent risk. I think that the what we have got right now is a pretty hot environment in the technology sector. We do know that the pace of the advance has picked up. This is when it is easiest to make money if you have a long position. The fact that the VIX index pulled back so violently on Monday is, I think, really not typing very effectively, excuse me. The fact that it pulled back so violently, that's an indication of people eschewing the need for any kind of hedging. People took out a lot of shorts, and I was one of them in March, and a lot of those shorts would have been stopped out last week. And then you have the VIX pulling back so sharply. And when you've been stopped out of a short, then people do get a bit shy about adding to it again. So, and then when you see shares like Google and Amazon surging higher, well then people are less inclined to have insurance. But when something becomes increasingly overextended relative to the trend mean, then that is the time when you need to have the insurance. And I think that that is something that is worth considering, that when you have a market that has been going up in such a dynamic manner, then that is the time to think about what would have to happen to at least to begin to take some profits off the table. That the best time to buy is following a pullback and a consolidation. I do not think that we're in any kind of environment like 2007 or 1999, but eventually the chances are that this phenomenal bull market will end in a bubble. The fact that it has been predicated on this enormous liquidity provision, and the eventual end of that liquidity provision, if it is not replaced by an equally impressive fiscal spend, then the chances are that we are going to get from a period where we have somewhat overvalued markets to very overvalued markets. So I think that the best time to buy is following a pullback. It's been a while since we've had one. We are ending the most favorable time of the year for stocks. It would not be beyond the bounds of possibility at all that we have a somewhat deeper pullback and consolidation at some time between now and September. And I think that is well worth keeping in mind when we see prices, especially like Amazon and Google, closing in on big psychological levels like $1,000. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.